Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we got some interesting stuff in store for you on today's podcast. In a little while, I'm going to do a movie review, not something that I normally do here on Intelligent Medicine, but it is a movie review worthy of your attention, and yes, it is related to medicine. And we'll also take a look at a supplement that not too many people know about. It's a wonderful supplement that helps to support immune system functioning. And before we do that, I came across a very interesting website recently. Something that was written about in the New York Post, and actually there was mention of it on the Drudge Report. So I made my way to a website entitled xvegans.com. xvegans.com is a website that takes a look at, it's a website where vegans can out traitorous ex-vegans who have gone to the dark side and have begun to eat meat. Okay, so it's fascinating because I go to the website and I see a picture, vegan sellout list, calling ex-vegans out by name. And there's a place where you can submit the name of the ex-vegan in question. You can start with the ex-vegan's basic information, their name, the state in which they reside, what city they're in. Also, you can provide a short description of the ex-vegan, but that's not enough. It says, now tell us everything you can about this person. It's kind of like an electronic version of those pillories and stocks that used to be used to punish miscreants in colonial America. You know, like the village square where you humiliate people and point to their transgressions. But it's there with an opportunity to provide additional details. You can even upload a photo of the ex-vegan to complete the harassment. You can enter their website or links to supplemental info if applicable. The year that they became vegan and the year that they, quote, sold out. I thought that was pretty amazing. And, you know, I thought of the first word that came to mind was the word apostate, which comes from the phenomenon of apostasy. I looked that word up in Wikipedia, and there's a quite detailed explanation of what apostasy is. But they say that the formal definition of apostasy is disaffiliation from or abandonment or renunciation of a religion by a person. And the way that these vegans have it, it's like a quasi-religion. It's like defecting from Scientology or leaving the Catholic Church, and or in the Muslim religion, the equivalent would be if they call down a fatwa on you because of heretical beliefs or joining the non-believers, the heretics. And apostasy has a long history. In the Middle Ages, apostates were harshly punished. Some were tortured and burned at the stake. There was an entire city of apostates in the Hundred Years' War. The city, I believe, in France was Carcassonne. And when the apostates of that city, the city was laid siege to, and the walls were breached, and the city was captured, and the inhabitants, they had subscribed to some misguided form of Catholicism, deviating in some doctrinal form from true Catholicism, it was thought. And the inhabitants of the city were paraded naked outside the city gates and dispersed into the four winds. The entire city was then burned, destroyed, and that's how they dealt with apostasy in the Middle Ages. More recently, defectors from repressive regimes, the Soviet Union, have been condemned and in some cases hunted down and assassinated. Leon Trotsky was a famous Russian apostate. He was a communist, but he deviated in a doctrinal way from the party line, and thus Stalin's agents hunted him down and assassinated him in Mexico. And, you know, it sounds a little bit exaggerated, but I deliberately choose the term apostate to refer to ex-vegetarians who renounce their dietary convictions and then become omnivores or carnivores. The website, exvegans.com, by the way, veganism is a extreme form of vegetarianism in which you don't eat any animal products. I mean, there are vegetarians who are ovo-lacto-vegetarians. They eat eggs and dairy, thus complementing their vegetarian food with some animal products, but not meat. I think the basic definition of vegetarian is that they don't eat meat or poultry, but there are what are called pesco-vegetarians. That's a little bit of a cheat because, well, a fish is an animal, but it's an animal that's maybe of a lower order than poultry and meat. And so there are pesco-vegetarians. But the vegans completely avoid the use of dairy products. They don't want to eat eggs. Some of them also don't want to clothe themselves in leather because it's derived from an animal. There's a close association between veganism and the animal rights movement. To some extent, there's a nexus with PETA, which is an extreme animal rights movement. And although there are many different types of vegans. There are vegans for health reasons. They believe that you shouldn't be eating animal protein because it's unhealthy, or they don't like animal fat. They think that dairy is unnatural. And then there are people who are ethical vegans. They just don't want to harm the animal world. And then there's some people who really believe that that is the ultimate diet. It's the ultimate refinement of a human diet. So to give you an idea of how these guys have hounded ex-vegans, in the Post story, they talk about an ex-vegan. His name is Berlin Reed, who became the author of a book interestingly titled The Ethical Butcher. So here's a guy who really departed from veganism, and he started writing about how you can eat meat. I didn't read the book, but presumably the theme of the book is how you can actually eat animal protein ethically, which is anathema, of course, to vegans. It turns out he's a former anarchist, and he's apparently non-white, which we'll talk about in just a second. He qualified for special castigation on the exvegans.com website. Here's what the entry says. Here we have yet another person hiding behind anarchism to justify their selfish behavior. No surprise, he's a part of the most shamed part of an already shamed subculture. The anarchist people of color. Eye roll. And I'm just sharing with you a quote from the vegan. I mean, that's a little bit harsh because they say, well, you know, they put him down for being a meat eater. They put him down for being an anarchist. But they also allude to his color. That's not very PC. But I thought it was kind of interesting because I have a little bit of perspective on this because I've been there, done that. Full disclosure, I am one of those vegan apostates because I have been macrobiotic during the early part of my medical training, and actually before my medical training, soon after college, I decided to take proactive steps to detoxify my body. I'd been eating all kinds of junk, standard American diet. I was somewhat health conscious in college. I prepared my own food, learned how to become self-sufficient, but, ate all kinds of junk, the pizza, the bagels, the usual stuff. And I also, I wasn't doing healthy stuff for myself. I was not exercising. I was smoking cigarettes. I was drinking a lot, the usual things that college students do. And so I decided to optimize my health. And within a few years of graduating college, I turned to the macrobiotic vegetarian diet to optimize my health. Now, macrobiotics is a Japanese-influenced form of veganism, in which adherents completely eschew any animal protein. However, in some cases, it's permitted to have small portions of fish or to flavor foods with some fish broth made from bonito flakes. But basically, it's a vegan diet. Absolutely no dairy, no eggs. The diet is based on lots of whole grains, beans, soy products, seaweed, certain vegetables, because you're not supposed to have nightshade vegetables, some nuts, and a little bit of fruit, but not too much fruit because it's thought that fruit is too sweet. So you're encouraged not to have lots of fruit. And I really leaned down on that diet and my energy and focus improved. I also gained a sense of self-mastery from a very disciplined dietary approach and a lifestyle which was healthier. I began exercising. I began doing yoga and using herbs. Vitamins are frowned on, by the way, in the macrobiotic philosophy, so it took a while for me to realize the potential of vitamins. And I maintained this way of eating for over 10 years, so quite a long time, throughout med school and medical training, which wasn't easy. I mean, I got a lot of ribbing from my med school colleagues because I would bring along elaborate lunches of brown rice and tofu and tempeh and beans and seaweed. And people just thought I was kind of weird in those days. But they saw that I was healthy and well and, they basically gave me respect. I remember one day during my internship at Bellevue Hospital, where we came into contact with a lot of patients who had hepatitis, one of the senior physicians urged me to get checked for hepatitis because my skin was yellowish. But I assured him that this was just because of all the kale and collard greens I was consuming, giving me sort of a yellowish orange tint, lots of beta carotene and carotenoids in my foods. So, but at the same time that I was doing this, part of going through this ritual of exclusivity with diet, one cultivates a profound sense of moral superiority. I wasn't part of that unwashed multitude engaging in all that indiscriminate eating. I would look askance at people eating hot dogs and hamburgers at barbecues. I would, in fact, at my medical school graduation, I brought my own tofu hot dogs and soy burgers. And there were a few people in my medical school class who said, oh, that's great. It's a nice alternative to the junky meat that was being served at the graduation party. I looked with disdain at people who were enjoying fatty foods, steak, eggs, chicken, even fish. Because in the world of the vegan, animal protein, and particularly saturated fat, epitomizes the evils inherent in the Western diet. And that was pretty much the worldview that was prevalent in the 70s and 80s. Also, to some extent, making a comeback now, that saturated fat is the villain, cholesterol is the main cause of cardiovascular disease. The fat that you eat in your diet literally clogs your arteries, or alternatively, feeds cancer cells. But the new thing is that the opposite may be true, is that sugars and starchy carbohydrates, which easily break down into sugar, may potentiate both heart disease and cancer and many other degenerative diseases by promoting insulin resistance. Insulin resistance drives up cytokines. It's immune suppressive. It boosts levels of harmful triglycerides. And to the extent the cholesterol hypothesis is true, which is debatable, in many cases, reducing carbohydrates helps to lower overall cholesterol and raise HDL. So we're beginning to think that some of these people who are eating lots and lots of starchy foods with virtually no animal protein, lots of vegetable oils that are rich in omega-6 fatty acids, they may be doing themselves harm. So long story short, late in the 1980s, I had already begun my medical practice. Initially, I would treat many patients by putting them on a macrobiotic diet. I was considered, in the very beginning of my career, to be the macrobiotic doctor of New York. And this helped a lot of people, helped them lose weight, certainly, reduce cardiovascular risk, because there are benefits to that diet. But I found, for me personally, I began developing lots of musculoskeletal problems, bodily aches and pains, dry skin, and allergies. They began to plague me. And I did a metabolic profile, which revealed me to be excessively alkaline. Now, for some people in the field of integrative and complementary medicine, the whole goal of diet is to make you more alkaline, because American diet is very acidic. There's lots of sugar and soda and meat and junk foods, and that makes the body acidic. So don't we want to become more alkaline? Well, it turns out I was too alkaline. And the antidote to that was to begin including more fat and animal protein in my diet, which I began to do. I began to include organic meat. And it wasn't easy, because I wasn't used to it. I had to kind of swallow my pride, too, because I was such a purist. And I had to let it go. I just had to abandon the exclusivity that veganism conferred upon me. And it was fascinating. I watched my body change. And within weeks, my problems resolved. By the way, my cholesterol went up. It had been as low as 110 or 115 with an HDL that was in the low 30s, which is a good profile, I guess, if you want to avoid cardiovascular disease, but the cholesterol a little low. And my cholesterol soared on the animal protein diet. It went up to 180, up to 200, but so did my HDL. My HDL went up to 65 or 70. And so from the standpoint of cardiovascular risks, my ratio was even better. So, you know, I got to say that in retrospect, to the credit of vegans, you got to admit that modern meat, fish, eggs, and dairy products are often the repositories of very harmful levels of environmental pollutants and toxins. Foods that are high on the food chain, animals eat plants on which stuff is sprayed and in which atmospheric pollutants land, and the water in the fields may be polluted. And so the higher you are on the food chain, just as the fish that are larger in the sea, they tend to have more pollutants in their bodies. And there's toxic residues that are either inadvertently coming from the environment or deliberately added, you know, as added to the feed, like arsenic to chicken feed, and various types of growth hormones and various types of antibiotics and harmful herbicides and pesticides. All these things are more concentrated in animal protein. So that's one argument, one strike against animal protein. However, you can, at least in part, circumvent that by seeking out organic and wild source products whenever possible. That's not always easy, but you know, it's more expensive. But if you're going to eat animal protein, that's what you got to do. But it's also true that if really look, got to look at the science of this. With the exception of dairy, the actual anthropological evidence indicates that animal products are an integral part of our evolutionary heritage, that we evolved by learning to hunt and fish. And perhaps, you know, 4 or 5 million years ago, we had monkey-like ancestors who were able to subsist on fruits and shoots. But part of human evolution was the ability to increase our protein intake and to grow larger brains and stronger bodies and to socialize around the activities of hunting and food preparation. And By the way, cholesterol and omega-3 fatty acids are integral to brain function. If you analyze the composition of the brain, very, very high levels of cholesterol. It's the organ in the body that, except perhaps for the liver, that has the highest concentration of cholesterol of any organ in the body. Actually, the brain does surpass the liver. And cholesterol and omega-3 fatty acids aren't easily synthesized when on an exclusively vegan diet. And that's why some studies indicate that people with very low cholesterol may be more prone to depression or violence or suicide. So there may be an impact on brain function when cholesterol is restricted. So I got to say, look, if you're a vegan due to strongly held moral beliefs about killing or exploiting animals, more power to you. I respect you. I mean, that's your belief. It's a profound belief. It's a philosophy. For some people, it is actually a religion. There's the Jain religion of India that believes in respect for all forms of life. And they try to eat really low on the food chain, causing as little disruption to the environment as possible. And that's okay. That's a religious belief. But if you try to justify your veganism on the basis that this is the ultimate natural human diet, or that this is what our ancestors consumed, that's just not right. I got a problem with that. A carefully chosen omnivorous diet more closely mirrors the diet that humans evolved upon. And the science, although it's often misinterpreted and misappropriated by vegetarian ideologues, apologists for vegetarianism, or simply people who want to beat the drum about vegetarianism, the science doesn't support the view that vegetarianism is the natural lot of humans. I'm sorry, it just doesn't. And that's, you're entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your facts. And I got to say that in my encounters with, I've interviewed, at this point, hundreds and hundreds of people on my radio program, and will continue to do so through these podcasts. And I have to say that some of my most challenging guests, the most difficult, least civil guests that I've ever dealt with on my radio program have been vociferous ideological vegetarians, vegetarians. They've been angry. They've been combative. They've been disrespectful. And what's that about? I mean, I have to say that, I take a tone of scientific equanimity when it comes to, you present your theory, I'll present mine, we'll debate it, that's fine. But to take it into the arena of denunciations and to create apostates who are then outed on websites, I just don't get that. So stigmatizing well-meaning individuals who are really seeking the truth about diet and may gravitate towards a carnivorous or omnivorous diet, that turns veganism into a quasi-religion or a cult, not a lifestyle choice. And I got to say, I'm pretty amazed at how far these devout vegans are in castigating their former adherents. Pretty amazing. And now for something completely different. The other night, it's summertime, and you're active during the daytime, and at night sometimes there's not much to do. So you sit around, you gather around the TV, and you look for a good movie to pick up on Netflix. And the movie that we selected was called Side Effects. It's a 2013 movie, and I recommend it very highly because it's a suspenseful movie with lots of twists and turns. And its theme is the side effects of a drug called Ablixa. Ablixa, in this movie, it's a fictional drug, a made-up thing, that is a new novel type of antidepressant that works, that's much more powerful than all the other previous antidepressants, that's good for people who, the many people who haven't responded to previous antidepressants. And it's new, it's got some potential side effects, but the psychiatrist in this movie, Jude Law, is persuaded by a colleague of his, Catherine Zeta-Jones, who plays another psychiatrist, to try out this new drug on a young patient. And the patient is played by Rooney Mara, who is of the Girl with a Dragon Tattoo fame. And I got to say, she is, I mean, she's not, you wouldn't call her a beauty, like in the conventional sense of actresses, but she is amazing because she's a real changeling. She has the ability in this movie to look really deranged, or to look very innocent, or to look very crafty and calculating. She really has a lot of different aspects. It's almost like she's a perfect director's mannequin. You can turn her into whatever, mold her into whatever kind of character he wants. And the director is Steven Soderbergh, who's known for some good movies, Syriana, and the movie about Edward R. Murrow, Good Night and Good Luck, and the TV series, which is K Street. And these movies are always suspenseful, a lot of twists and turns. Okay, well, you know, spoiler alert here. So cover your ears if you don't want to know what happens at the beginning of the movie. But I assure you that even if you know what happens at the beginning of the movie, it's still not going to spoil your enjoyment of the movie, because this, it goes way beyond what I'm about to share with you. Is in the movie, one of the protagonists, a young girl played by Rooney Mara, her husband goes off to jail, and she's very depressed because, I mean, he was busted for insider trading. And when he comes back, they don't have any money, they're poor, and she gets very depressed. And so she goes to the psychiatrist, in this case, Jude Law, who does a great job with his British accent, playing a very gifted and sophisticated young psychiatrist. And he is caring and compassionate. And finally, he says, I think you need to try Ablixiv because you're not responding to anything. He's kind of worried about her. She even appears to be suicidal. So he puts her on Ablixiv. And the next thing that happens is, in a very lurid fashion, she murders her husband, Channing Tatum. He comes home from work. He's in the kitchen cutting something with a knife, and she turns around and stabs him repeatedly in horrifying fashion. So, and that's just where the plot begins. It starts to take off there, because what's going on? Why did she do it? Is it a drug side effect? Well, among the documented side effects of Ablixiv, and by the way, just a reminder, this is a fictional drug, but this is very parallel to real life, because sometimes these drugs work great, and sometimes they have very serious side effects. And so here you have, I'm going to just play this for you. This is off YouTube. It's a fake commercial. This really faked me out at first, because I checked it out, and I said, boy, this is just exactly like those drug commercials that you see on TV. It's got, you know, it's all the production values. It shows a gloomy person in the beginning sitting there with a cloud over their head, and then they take Ablixiv. And the slogan, they even have a great advertising slogan. It's "Take back your life with Ablixiv." And then they show, you know, everything's getting better. You've seen these ads on TV for antidepressants, and it makes it seem like, wow, it's all going to be great. But then a little voiceover that you barely pay attention to enumerates all the dire side effects of the psychiatric drug, which, of course, occur very infrequently, but you certainly don't want these things to happen to you. So listen to this little excerpt from YouTube on the fictional drug Ablixiv.
It can steal away your time and crush all of your hopes. But starting today, there's a new way to get them back. Introducing Ablixiv, a new prescription medication that can help you take back tomorrow from depression. Women who are pregnant or breastfeeding should not take Ablixiv. Common side effects include dizziness, increased appetite, joint pain or stiffness, dry mouth, and headaches. Rare side effects may also include confusion, suicidal thoughts, and sleep disturbances, including sleepwalking. Ablixa is not recommended for children under 18 years of age. Ask your doctor about Ablixa today. Ablixa. Take back tomorrow.
So, I hope that you heard that. The volume was a little low on that. But the side effects include sleepwalking. And, yeah, there have been cases, documented cases, of people doing really strange things in their sleep while they're on sleep medications or psychiatric drugs. There are episodes of people having sex while they're asleep. That's actually fairly common. People can sleepwalk. They can go to the refrigerator and eat stuff. That's not so great if you're trying to follow a diet. They can even, leave the house and end up at the mall, drive the car, and they do so while they're in a quasi-sleep state. It's pretty weird stuff. And actually, there have been lawsuits that have been settled for actions that have been committed under the influence of psychiatric drugs. And there have been some verdicts put aside in terms of out-and-out murder, violent acts where people did so under the influence of psychiatric drugs. So, I mean, I think it's a timely theme. We're talking about a real phenomenon that occurs. And, there's more in the movie about some of the machinations of the pharmaceutical industry in relationship to how they try to cover up the fact that this drug may be responsible for a lurid murder. You'll enjoy the movie. It's Side Effects, a movie by Steven Soderbergh, and it's available, on your, these days you don't have to go to Blockbuster and get the videotape. You can just download it directly from Netflix or from your cable provider. Finally, on this edition of Intelligent Medicine, we're going to talk about a supplement that I use quite a lot in my practice, which I think you should know about. The product is Active Hexose Correlated Compound, often abbreviated to AHCC. The brand name of the product that I use is Empower, because it supports immunity. And actually, I understand that it is the number one selling nutraceutical in Japan. And it is actually something that the Japanese government reimburses. It's not something that is you buy in a health food store. It's actually used a lot in medicine, particularly in support of patients who are treated for cancer. And it's a highly scientific product. It's based on the notion that mushrooms have an immune-supporting effect, and traditionally mushrooms have been used to support immunity in traditional Chinese medicine and then Japanese medicine. There are definitely some immune-stimulating characteristics of the polysaccharides that are present in mushrooms, and the Japanese have concentrated and perfected these principles in Active Hexose Correlated Compound, or AHCC. It's an enzyme fermented extract of the Basidiomycetes mushroom. And it's a complex compound that is a mixture of polysaccharides, amino acids, lipids, and minerals. And in particular, it contains alpha-1-4-glucans, which are thought to be the active constituent in AHCC. These glucan compounds are part of the polysaccharide molecules, and they seem to have immune-stimulating effects. So there are a variety of studies that point in that direction. And the Japanese have really done a lot of work on this because, well, they use it in cancer. So many of these studies come to us from Japan. And so I'm going to share with you some basic details from studies answering various questions about the activity and efficacy of AHCC. So one question might be, does AHCC have an effect on immune function of healthy adults age 50 or greater? We know that there is something called immunosenescence, which means that the immune system declines as you age. And this is one of the reasons why vaccines tend to fail in a high percentage of adults, the very older, vulnerable adults, where we need the vaccines to work. Vaccines used for preventing shingles or preventing the flu or preventing pneumonia. This is a big problem. So in this study, they gave 3 grams of AHCC per day, 500 milligram capsules twice daily. By the way, one of the reasons for patients to fail on AHCC, I've noticed, is the product Empower and many standard AHCC products are 500 milligram products. So patients take one twice daily, and that's not nearly enough. So most of these studies are based on taking anywhere from 3 to 5 grams per day. And particularly in cancer, you may want to take higher doses. So what they found was that in these older adults, there was improvements in what are called CD4 and CD8 T cells producing interferon gamma. So the CD4 cells are referred to as helper T cells, and they are very important in terms of warding off disease. There's also interest in the effects of AHCC on what are called NK cells. These are a type of circulating T cells. T cells are derived from the thymus, which is that's why they're called T cells. Thymus-derived lymphocytes, their type of white blood cell, that helps to fight off invaders and may even attack cancer. So here's a study with the theme, does AHCC have an effect on the immune responses in healthy volunteers? 21 healthy volunteers, 3 grams of AHCC. They found that there was an improvement in what are called dendritic cells. These are antigen-presenting cells capable of priming tumor-specific T cells. They help in the body's cancer surveillance and cancer defense. So the conclusion is HCC could be an effective modulator of immunological function in patients with cancer. Although these patients did not have cancer, they were just healthy adults. So, but their cancer defenses were revved up. Does AHCC have an effect on immune response of healthy adults after influenza vaccines? Very interesting study, 29 healthy adults. HCC supplementation resulted in increases in natural killer cells. Cytotoxic NK, or natural killer cells, were higher in the HCC group, and the HCC supplementation had a more dramatic effect on immune cell function after vaccination in individuals over 60, precisely the population where we need to boost vaccine effectiveness. Is HCC safe and tolerable in healthy subjects? They gave 9 grams of liquid HCC to people, and they didn't find any problems. They concluded that it was safe. Now let's look at cancer, prostate cancer. Does HCC have an effect on patients with early-stage prostate cancer? Dosage, 4.5 grams of HCC per day. That would be 9 capsules of Empower. And what they found was that there was a slowing in the doubling time of PSA following 6 months of HCC. And that suggests a slowing in the progression of the early prostate cancer. So I definitely use it in patients where we're doing active surveillance, watchful waiting, as an alternative to radiation or surgery for prostate cancer. And it's now an accepted notion that not every patient needs to get immediate aggressive therapy. Patients with low-grade prostate cancer can be observed, and with things like HCC, that'll slow their progression. More on prostate cancer, 3 grams of HCC in this study, a significant decline in the tumor-associated antigens in 8 out of 11 patients with actually, in this case, different malignancies, but PSA levels in prostate cancer patients and CA-125 levels in ovarian cancer patients decreased in patients receiving HCC. So very cool. This is something we want to use in those types of cancers. the, you know, I'm not going to read all these studies to you, but liver cancer, one of the most challenging types of cancer, 3 grams of HCC per day. There was longer non, by the way, liver cancer, very, very prevalent in Japan, more prevalent than it is here. There was a longer non-recurrence period and an increased overall survival rate with 3 grams of HCC per day. That would be 6 capsules per day. That's pretty, pretty economical. Another study looking at liver cancer, 6 grams of HCC, prolonged survival, increased levels of serum albumin, and quality of life was improved after 3 months of HCC. Breast and lung cancer, 2.25 to 4.5 grams of HCC. There was improved 1, 2, and 3 year survival rates for stage 4 lung cancer. There was an improvement in 1 year to 3 year survival rates for lung cancer stage 4. And quality of life scores were improved in many of the patients taking this. Breast cancer patients, the study concluded that patients receiving HCC might have improved prognosis in stage 4, although it wasn't clear that there was a benefit in stage 1, 2, and 3. So some evidence of improvement, but it wasn't a knockout. Gastric and colon cancer, there are also some studies. 3 grams, actually, this in this case, 9 grams, no, excuse me, 1 gram of HCC 3 times daily. So 3 grams per day. For patients with more advanced cancer, 6 grams of HCC. There was improved cumulative 5 year survival rates for patients with stomach cancer. That's pretty good. And, you know, something to mention, and, you know, there's studies, I won't belabor you with the details on this, but comparable studies on pancreatic and biliary cancer, head and neck cancer. And, you know, a concern is when you're going to the oncologist, oncologists will often say, look, stop taking your supplements. And they're well-meaning because they just think that supplements mess up conventional therapies. They're not sure how or why, but they just don't want to take a chance. So, however, they're misguided because if you look at the effects of individual supplements, some of them may interfere, but many of them don't, and many of them may actually enhance the effects of conventional therapy and keep the patient healthier during a challenging immunosuppressive treatment program. So this is a study on reduction of chemotherapy side effects. The study suggests that HCC can be used for prevention of bone marrow depression from chemotherapy. And it seems to be safe and good for cancer patients. And it acts as what's called a biological response modifier, helping the immune system target the cancer more appropriately. So was there a negative effect vis-a-vis the chemo? No, it was safe, well-tolerated. It helped to improve quality of life for patients, and it helped to preserve immunity. And finally, I'll comment on HCC with hepatitis, which is, you know, chronic hepatitis C in particular, hard to treat. Some patients don't respond to drugs. And what they found was that there was, in the case of hepatitis C, particularly with subgroup genotype 3, there are different subtypes of hepatitis C, there was a significant decline in the hep C virus scores when patients were given 6 grams of HCC per day. Also, liver functions improved. So even in patients who have non-viral chronic abnormal liver function, 1 to 3 grams of HCC per day resulted in improvement. And there are many people who have got, you know, liver issues and there's no virus. They just have a fatty liver condition or a mysterious type of elevation in their liver functions. And HCC appears to be supportive to liver function, according to the study. So, you know, a bunch of studies. It's a well-studied, well-characterized, natural agent, safe, well-tolerated, easy to use, and it won't interfere with most conventional therapies. The product goes by various names. Empower is the product that we carry in our dispensary at the Hoffman Center. So concludes today's podcast. Thanks for joining us for yet another one, and we look forward to sharing more information with you on our next podcast.